From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is on vacation this week. Our guest analyst is Arelis Hernandez. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering Maryland. Arelis, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Rashern Baker, County Executive for Prince George's County. Joining us in studio now is Kathy Patterson. She is the auditor for the District of Columbia. Kathy Patterson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
If you have questions or comments for the auditor, you can call us at 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast. Ask a question or comment there on a general topic. Before we get to the specific reports that the auditor has been issuing, so it would appear prolifically these last few weeks, is that the Congressional Black Caucus has decided to jump into the issue of missing girls in Washington, D.C. NBC4 reporting that the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Chairman Cedric Raymond Richmond of Louisiana, joined with D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, calling on the Attorney General and the FBI Director to devote the resources necessary to determine whether these developments, meaning the missing black children, especially missing black girls, devote the resources necessary to determine whether these developments are an anomaly or whether they are indicative of an underlying trend that must be addressed. However, Metropolitan Police Department spokeswoman says that the number of missing child cases in the district have actually dropped. They've just been posting them on social media more often. So, Arelis, Kathy Patterson, we don't know whether or not this is a problem that is increasing or if it's just that our attention is being brought to it.
Right. At this time. In this case, it's a bunch of different. It's not just Washington, but and I know of a few cases of Latino, young Latino women in Fairfax County as well that have gone missing. And in this case, it seems to be the publicity and sort of the public asking the question as to, you know, where's the coverage of these cases and assisting the families when they go to these detectives that looking for answers and updates on their cases.
Indeed, Kathy Patterson, it seems that this has been a problem for years. We're just becoming really fully aware of it.
Right, right.
And I guess, therefore, we need to be doing something about it. And the Congressional Black Caucus feels that the FBI can help in this quest. It's a story that we'll be following as we move along. On to the reports. Affordable housing in D.C. has been in the news for a number of issues, including a major property owner who is being sued by the city for terrible conditions. But your office, Kathy Patterson, has been looking into the financial side of affordable housing in D.C. In a report released last week, you found, not for the first time, that the district's affordable housing fund, the Housing Production Trust Fund, some $100 million annually, more than any other city, I should mention, has a host of problems. What is this fund meant to do, and what are some of the concerns you raise in your report?
Well, the one thing just to be aware of is that this is the first time that there's been an audit done of the Housing Production Trust Fund since it began being funded in 2001. So we've put quite a lot of district resources into this.
More than $1 billion.
Right, right. And it's been in operation that length of time, and frankly doing what it's supposed to do, which is incentivizing the construction and renovation of affordable housing. And one of the good features about it is it only uses 49% district funds, so the rest of the funds on each project are private or some federal and so on. So we are building the units or renovating the units. What we were looking at is what happens then. So we were looking at the agency's oversight, the monitoring. Are units that are affordable, do they stay affordable? Do they continue to house people who qualify? And we're finding that the projects in our sample didn't necessarily recertify people by virtue of income. Another issue we found was lack of paying back the loans as they're owed. Again, the trust fund is a revolving fund. The idea is these are very low-level interest rates and very creative ways of getting that housing built, but the money does come back. And we found that of the 9 of the 14 projects in our sample owed about $1.1 million. Again, this is a sample, so we know the number is a lot bigger than that in terms of what's owed. That money needs to come back in and then go back out again for affordable housing.
Who owes us that money?
The different projects, in some cases it's a developer, in some cases it's ownership, individual owners of projects. Some of them are multifamily, they might be condos, and then over time they're purchased by the people living in them. There are a lot of very different and frankly very creative projects out there, but the thing that we were concerned about is just making sure that we're continuing to hew to the reasons for this program in the first place.
You offer a range of remedies for the issues the district has had managing this housing fund. What does the city need to do to manage the program better?
It needs to pay attention, one, to some of the requirements that are in the program's statutory authority. One of the issues is that there is supposed to be an annual audit done by an outside CPA firm. And we first pointed this out to the agency, to Polly Donaldson, the agency's leadership, a year or so ago. And they are moving forward. They have contracted for that first outside audit. So that's one step. But they're also supposed to be providing reports to the council on a regular basis. And one of the issues that we found is some of the data they were providing isn't correct. And we're actually building ourselves a database of all the projects, 200 and some projects since 2001, the total dollars, total units, all those details. The agency over time hasn't really maintained that database of the projects.
But where's the enforcement here? You're a former member of the D.C. Council. Many people are concerned that there seems to be no enforcement when developers do not build the required affordable units. Are there ways that that can be addressed? Is this something that the council needs to be looking at more aggressively?
I think making sure that the required reports are made, making sure that the things that are statutorily required are done. I do think that the current leadership of the department is really working hard on some of these issues and really trying to be compliant. But I think it's a matter of just being assured that the program that is such a high priority program is managed as well as it can possibly be, including getting those loan payments back in, including making sure that the people living in the units are the low-income folks who they were built
but for. But we never read in the media about the developers being penalized for not meeting the affordable housing requirements in these developments, which is the question I raise again about the lack of enforcement. Is it that we're simply not seeing reports about the enforcement, or is it that there is really a lack of enforcement?
That's a question that we posed to a lot of the folks on the economic development side of the administration in a report we put out during the year last year. And one of the things that they came back with in a response to us was, by incentivizing developers to do more work with the city, we expect them to be complying. And therefore, that's the point at which we in the executive branch look at their compliance when they come back again for some additional incentives from the city. So that's one way, that's one place in time that enforcement can be managed. But it is a persistent issue. It's an issue that we will keep harping on in the different reports that we do.
Incentives, schmincentives. I want to see people going to jail. Aurelis?
Well, it sounds like it's a system of positive reinforcement, right? You do things right, we'll come back and we'll give you another incentive to be a part of it. But it, as it stands now, there are no penalties for these developers or these owners to comply with these rules.
The penalties in different programs, it's really different. The one that we looked at, the Housing Production Trust Fund, we did not look explicitly at whether they did or didn't build what they were supposed to build. We were looking at the overall management once the units are there. And there's not really a penalty for failing to file checking the finances every year, the recertification. So there's not really an enforcement tool there other than going back to them and, you know, producing having the staff to be able to go out there and do the monitoring and be in touch with the projects and things like that. So it's really, there are many, many aspects to it and many steps, but I'm not aware, frankly, of an enforcement tool in terms of a punishment for failing to do the recertifications.
In case you're just joining us, our guest analyst on the Politics Hour today is Aurelis Hernandez. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering Maryland. We're talking with Kathy Patterson, the auditor for the District of Columbia, and taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Rashawn Baker, the county executive for Prince George's County. Kathy Patterson, your office has also audited the district's public university, the University of the District of Columbia. Why did you decide there was a need to do that?
This was something that actually was on the drawing boards before I got there. The office does a risk assessment every couple of years, looking at high priority programs, high dollar value programs, and the university was something that was a program that the office decided to take a look at. When we then refined what we were going to look at, we picked some, and this is when I was on the job, we looked at some elements of the strategic plan that the university's board adopted, and one of the things that plan seemed to move in the direction of was trying to make sure that the academic offerings really meshed well with what the District of Columbia and the region needed in terms of, you know, job possibilities for the graduates. And that was one of the aspects that we did take a look at, whether they were paring back academic offerings that were not high priority in terms of either what students are looking for or what employers are looking for, and also looking at them being able to ramp up those professions, say in the health professions, nursing, things that we knew that there's a great demand for in the community. And we've found very mixed results. They had done some paring back of academic offerings, but they hadn't really built up some of the ones that they had said they were going to.
Your report does note that the UDC has taken some solid steps. What are they doing well, and what are some of the recommendations you lay out?
One of the things that they have done, as I mentioned, is they have pared back and stopped teaching some of the classes that either students weren't signing up for or that didn't really lead to majors or to degrees that would really help graduates in the employment world. So that is one thing that they are doing. And we're making some recommendations that they go forward with another one of their goals, which had to do with additional online course offerings. That's something that they put in their strategic plan but hadn't really delivered on. So that's another thing that we're recommending that they follow up on.
Here's Brian in Northwest Washington. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good day, Kojo and Ms. Patterson. My question is, I'm a CBE firm in Washington, D.C., and you go and you do these audits, and then your audits come back and say, hey, what these agencies aren't doing, and then you make and you make recommendations. My question is, I'm not seeing enough audits on the agencies and what they're not spending in your recommendations. We just saw a large non-CBE company get a $95 million tax abatement, but then turn around and sold a company when they were supposed to create 1,000 jobs. And so we need to know what's your recommendation to the council dealing with CBEs and SBEs and work, and what are you finding in these audits?
CBEs are certified business enterprises. SBEs, I guess, are small business enterprises.
Right. There's a whole series of categories of small, disadvantaged, community-owned, different categories of certified business enterprises that Brian is referring to. We have a role that's actually a statutory role my office does in working with DSLBD, which is the agency that oversees the CBE program, to work with them on the district government expenditures with CBE. So that's something that we do regular audits of how the district itself is doing. We also are working with them to try to improve the way they work and deal with some of the firms and some of the enforcement issues, as I mentioned earlier in one of the reports that we did last year. We're also taking a look at, in terms of employment, we're taking a look at the First Source program, which is supposed to encourage private sector companies that have business with the District of Columbia or that take advantage of incentives that are government incentives, how they are doing in terms of hiring local individuals. So we're trying to do what we can with our audit plan to look at some of the issues that Brian is speaking of.
Brian, is your concern that some of these CBEs and SBEs are not legitimate CBEs or SBEs?
No, that's not my concern.
Oh, okay.
I just saw the city council roll out to, like, Living Social a big tax abatement, to another group a big tax abatement. But these companies end up selling and going out of business. And
okay.
Is it any suggestion that maybe you reverse it and do it with smaller companies to create these jobs? Because the bigger guys are just rolling out and selling themselves. So why not build it from the true base of the people that's going to hire the people?
The smaller companies, always making the argument that they are not being paid sufficient attention. Each year, there are concerns about the Marion Barry Summer Youth Employment Program, including how the money is spent. Your office has looked into this, and not for the first time. What did you find this night?
We found that this continues to be a major priority program for the District of Columbia, which is no surprise. It's been around for quite a long time. We've actually done a series of four reports on the program based on a request from the council and some additional funding that came to the office for this project. The report that we put out just last week looks at some of the controls in place to make sure that there isn't the opportunity for waste, fraud, or abuse in the program. And we highlighted some concerns. There are some funds that are not a huge amount in the scheme of things, about $43,000 not accounted for. We found some of the wage rates that were paid out to young people were different from what the statutory requirements are. We have some concerns that we raise with their information systems not having an audit trail. So you or I could go in and say, well, let's pay Arellis, you know, $12 an hour instead of $10 an hour and not have a trail that says I'm the one who made that change. So there are certain things like this. The agency has indicated that they are fixing the audit trail issue, and they're going to be looking at purchasing a new information system. One of the other reports that we did that I think has a lot to offer in terms of policymakers, we looked at other summer jobs programs in eight other big cities. Mm-hmm. One of the things we found, we actually serve many, many more young people per capita than other programs, but other programs have much stronger ties and relationships with the business community. Other cities have more jobs that are subsidized by the private sector employers. They have programs with some of their major employers taking on large numbers of young people. Chicago has a program that's aimed at youth that might be at risk for criminal activity, and they target young people in particular neighborhoods for the mentoring program. So there are a number of things that we found in other cities that we hope will be useful to the council as they continue to look at this program.
Because this program has always had a kind of two-sided reputation. On the one hand, there are those who say this is the program that gave them the opportunity for their first jobs. On the other hand, there are those who criticize the program for not giving them what they consider real jobs, jobs that they're likely to encounter in the real world. So are you suggesting that if the ties with the business community are closer, then the training that these young people receive is likely to be more relevant to their future work experience?
Absolutely. The program itself probably has more young people in educational programs, in skills development, in soft skills development, than in actual work readiness programs. But the second one, the latter, the work readiness programs, really would be enhanced if the agency would work much more, spend a lot more time working with some of our larger local employers.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in Congress today. They're supposed to be voting this afternoon on the bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Back in January, you did a report assessing what a straight-up repeal would mean for the District of Columbia. What do you make of the direction Congress is going in right now, and how might it affect the district?
Well, I think it's not good news for us, just like it's not good news for most jurisdictions around the country. The extent to which they pare back the Medicaid expansion would be particularly costly to the District of Columbia. The different ways in which they're looking at shrinking the program or changing the Medicaid program, either block granting it or turning it into a capitated program, these would all have very serious financial consequences. We concluded it would be about a $560 million hit the first year and a hit of $1 billion a year over time. But one of the things to keep in mind about the district is we were looking to cover a much larger portion of our population before the Affordable Care Act than were most other jurisdictions. I think maybe that Massachusetts might be the only jurisdiction that was covering a larger proportion of its population. So when the Affordable Care Act hit and we got this wonderful Medicaid expansion, that actually replaced local dollars with federal dollars, and we were able to broaden our coverage. So we have a policy track record of covering a very large proportion of our population, and my guess is the policymakers will not want to go backward, and so it's going to really require being very creative in terms of how we make up any difference in terms of dollars if the federal dollars diminish as we expect them to.
Here's Rosemary in Washington, D.C. Rosemary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. I'm going back to the statement she made about incentives for contractors.
Yes.
I would say if that was at all logical, why aren't we giving people a incentive for abiding by the law and ignoring it when they break it? I see contractors being enabled to continue to skirt rules and skirt the law without having repercussions for negative action. I think it's great to reward contractors that comply by giving them more jobs, but I think there should also be the denial of jobs to contractors that continue to not comply.
I think that's a very good point. And one of the things, one of the ways we do our reports, we have findings, we have recommendations, and then we send the reports in draft to the agencies for their comment. And one of the things that we then get back from the executive branch government agencies are their commitments going forward. And we have heard from the Bowser administration, from a number of the agencies, particularly in the economic development realm, that they will be enforcing some of the rules that are on the books. They have actually gone after at least one contractor with a fine for not adhering. I believe it was the first source not adhering to that. And what my office can do, because we have these promises made in agency responses to audit reports, we go back to them every we do a compliance review and say, okay, you promised you were going to do these enforcements. How many have you done? Please document that. So we do follow up on our recommendations, and that's one of the ways in which we'll be looking at the enforcement issue over time.
Thank you very much for your call, Rosemary. Got to say that your reports are a font of information about stuff that people didn't know about the District of Columbia. Your office is also working into the home visiting program. That's where trained family support workers make regular in-home visits to families. What are the benefits of that program for children?
That's a program that has been around for a couple of decades, and it's an intervention with a mother, a poor mother, expecting her first child. It's typically an intervention that starts working with that pregnant mother and then works with her through the first maybe 6 months to 3 years of the child's life. And it's a parent coaching program. Typically nurses or social workers or other trained providers will work with a family to try to make sure that the new mother or the new parents know what they're doing in terms of child rearing. And it's something that there have been studies over the last 20 years of home visiting as a child welfare and an early education intervention that have shown real progress both in getting children ready for school and in some cases with a nurse family partnership, a particular home visiting model with reducing instances of abuse and neglect. So it's an intervention that can be a very, very constructive one.
It's my understanding the district doesn't have the capacity to include nearly as many families as could benefit. What's the issue?
What we wanted to do with this report that DC Action for Children wrote for us was to say, given that this is an intervention that research shows will be helpful to at-risk families, what are we doing here in the district? And so what they've done in this report is cataloged what kinds of programs we have, in which agencies are they operating, and really just to provide a status report to the council so that they can use it in their budget deliberations. And if they decide this is something that they really want to make a bigger investment in, they sort of have the ground rules or the basic information that's out there right now.
Kathy Patterson, she is the auditor for the District of Columbia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Good to see you.
Our guest analyst is Aurelis Hernandez. She is a reporter for the Washington Post covering Maryland, and so she'll be taking over this discussion when our next guest comes aboard. He is warming up in the bullpen even as we speak, getting ready to pitch here today. Rashern Baker is the county executive for Prince George's County. He'll be joining us in studio shortly. But since we are now in Maryland, Aurelis, talk a little bit about what's going on with the ban on the hydraulic fracturing for natural gas in Maryland. There was some surprise in Maryland last week when Republican Governor Larry Hogan announced his support for banning the drilling process because he'd stated earlier that this was something he might be able to live with.
Yeah, no, it came as a huge surprise politically for a lot of us who've been watching this particular issue. It's an issue that's come up quite often in Annapolis. There are very frequent protests on this particular issue and quite a lot of lobbying from environmental groups behind it. And it was a sweet political move on Hogan's part because it was super unpopular with Marylanders in general in certain parts of the state. So definitely surprised all of us.
You can watch this conversation on our live video stream at our website, kojoshow.org, where you will see the Prince George's County executive holding up pads of paper trying to distract Aurelis Hernandez, but she will not be distracted at this point. It apparently moved ahead, this issue, in the Senate this past week.
I believe so. I think that the Senate had expressed some hesitance towards a full-out or permanent ban, and we're looking at a moratorium, and they were trying to work those things out.
Rashawn Baker joins us in studio. He's the county executive for Prince George's County. Thank you for joining us.
Kojo, so great to be here with you.
If you have questions or comments for the county executive, call us at 800-433-8850. I will let Aurelis Hernandez set the agenda by asking the first question. You can also join the conversation at our website, kojoshow.org, or go to send us a tweet at kojoshow or send us an email, kojo@wamu.org.
Kojo, you didn't tell me we were going to have someone from the Clippers here.
From the Clippers?
Oxon Hill High School. Graduated from Prince George's County Schools, yes.
I did not know that. Now ask him a question that's going to really make him uncomfortable.
My pleasure, Kojo, my pleasure. So you've told us that you won't tell us affirmatively until after the session's over whether you're going to run for governor. However, you've been traipsing around the state. You went to the Eastern Shore recently. How much closer are you to sort of saying affirmatively that that's the case, and give us any clues here as to whether that starts today or what happened on the Eastern Shore.
You confirm what we already know.
Well, you know, I did enjoy the time on the Eastern Shore. You know, one of the places I went to was Salisbury State University. A number of our children from Prince George's County go to that great university. And just to talk about, you know, we have a great university, several great universities in the county, University of Maryland, Bowie State University, Prince George's Community College, and how we've been able to use those higher education institutions to revamp the county. And so we talked to the folks there about that. You know, some of the issues that we face in Prince George's County, the same they face on the Eastern Shore, whether it's around education, access to quality health care, certainly transportation, dealing with roads and bridges. And so a partnership so that we could go to Annapolis and make sure that the entire state is represented. So I enjoyed going out there talking to the residents.
You've been in Annapolis before as a member of the General Assembly.
That's right.
When are your plans to go back to Annapolis again as governor going to be announced?
That was very good, Kojo. I enjoyed my time in Annapolis, and I am really close to an answer. I think for me, is especially coming out of this last budget in Prince George's County, looking at the things we've been able to do in the turnaround in the county, and traveling the state and trying to see if some of the things I've learned in Prince George's County and my time in Annapolis could help the state move forward. I think there are a lot of issues facing us, especially with what's going on at the federal level that we need to prepare the county and the state for.
Bottom line is you're close to an announcement.
I'm very close.
You announced in February that you would keep Kevin Maxwell on as school CEO. The first time in nearly 25 years, the school's chief got a second term. In his 3.5 years, he's overseen some positive results, the highest graduation rates the county has seen, the expansion of pre-K programs, but also persistent achievement gaps, as well as the child sex abuse scandals and other mistreatment of children. Why did you choose to go that route and not to seek new leadership, or at least retain the option of seeking new leadership to address those challenges?
Well, one is that when you're picking a superintendent in the state of Maryland, it's a 4-year contract. So the decision was whether, in fact, this was the right individual to continue to lead the school system. Looking at the totality of his time and tenure as superintendent and CEO, I think he's done a great job. Have there been challenges? Yes, we knew there were going to be challenges no matter who was in that seat. And going forward, we're going to face challenges. What I said to him is, I want to know how you deal with the issues that come up. And academically, I don't think anyone ever had a problem with the way he was trying to push the school system and is pushing the school system. My concern during the whole, Caraway incident was, how do you deal and get confidence in people for safety issues? Because people pull their children out of schools if they feel that they're not safe. And what I've seen is him address the issue, you know, head on, make some tough decisions about personnel. But also what I've been, you know, pleased with is the fact that we have increased our roles in our school system. They have not decreased, even in what we call our Early Start program, not the Head Start, the one that the school system's running. Prince Georgians left their children in that program.
Aurelis?
Well, I'm curious. You and I have talked about some of the issues that are pervasive within the school system, one of them being an issue of culture, right? What has Maxwell done to your satisfaction to address those systemic issues?
That is absolutely a spot-on question, and it's one that we posed to him. And what I've said, and I think you've heard me say this, that was an issue I raised with him before the issues around the Caraway case came about. How do we make sure that we get the culture of the school system differently? It's a big ship to try and turn. I was pleased with the answers in terms of, his deputy staffs, you know, that he put in charge of these things, Monica Golson, Dr. Golson, and Dr. Davis, I think, you know, have put together a whole issue of dealing with changing the culture from the bottom up. Not just the teachers and principals, but every man and woman who works and touches the school system. Is it going to take a while to do that? Yes, but I'm already starting to see results. Yes, we are. Because one, people are voting with their feet. They're coming back to our school system. And two, we don't see the exodus of teachers and principals we've seen in years before. Because there is continuity. And I think that's one of the things about retaining him is there's continuity in the system. And people know what to expect from his leadership.
You mentioned the fact that the superintendent has done well on academic matters and that security is a concern for everyone. An alleged rape at a high school next door in Montgomery County has gotten national attention, in part because the suspects are undocumented immigrants. Schools always have a challenging line to walk, ensuring that they're welcoming to immigrant students and their families while protecting students from those who may be a danger to others. There have also been reports about a rise in violence associated with young MS-13 gang members. How is Prince George's County approaching this, and are you considering any guidance for schools?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we did early on, and I'm glad that Dr. Maxwell agreed to this, it was one of my requirements, and that is the school security system personnel sits in our crime briefings so that we not only get an update on what's going on with our police department, our sheriff's department, but also in our schools, and so that we make sure they're coordinating the safety of the students who are going in and out of our school system. So that if there are lapses, you know, that our police can follow up on. I mean, it's a tough thing. Well, we've got to be vigilant, but not
intrusive, if you will.
Intrusive or violating people's, you know, constitutional rights. It's a hard line. So for us, it's information, is making sure that our police department, our sheriff's department, and the school security are talking to each other every day. And if our police department and our state's attorneys in there also are seeing a rise in gang activities around, you know, we know what segment of the county that's coming. That has to influence what the school security is doing in their preparation and how they work together with us.
If you have questions or comments about school security in Prince George's County, now is the time to call 800-433-8850. Aurelis?
I'm curious about Spanish-speaking personnel and the immigration issues surrounding some of the students in the school system. I think one in four kindergartners in Prince George's County schools are Hispanic. Not to say that almost, you know, all immigrants are Hispanic, but I'm curious as to some of the overtures that your government has made, school system and otherwise, to protect kids. If you had a choice between receiving federal funding and keeping ICE agents out of schools or honoring detainers, what would be your choice?
Well, my choice would be, one, to follow the charter and laws of Prince George's County and follow the Constitution of the United States and make sure that everyone who's a resident of Prince George's County understands they're going to be safe and that their rights are going to be violated.
So honoring detainer, losing federal funding.
Well, you know, what we've said to our police department is follow the law. You know, our police department and our government are not, you know, federal agencies. You know, we're not ICE. That is not what they're paid to do. We want to make, and we'll follow the law. If we have people who have detainers for violent crimes, then, you know, we will, I think we will turn them over. But we don't ask immigration status when we, you know, arrest people. We don't ask immigration status when we interview victims. We don't ask immigration status, you know, when our health department's providing health. Because what we don't want to do is create more unsafety. You know, what happens with the Trump administration, we saw this during the campaign, is that the rhetoric around, you know, people's immigration status was making people believe that they were going to be pulled out of school. And many of these were not, you know, they were undocumented. They were not here illegally. But it made people start wondering whether, in fact, they, you know, could, because of language barriers, whether they should send their children to school, whether they should report crimes, whether they should do things like that. And that will cause a real problem for us to close cases and to provide safety. And so we said to folks, you know, our policy will remain the same. It was the same policy under the Obama administration. It's the same policy under the Trump administration.
Well, the state, the House of Delegates just passed earlier this week the Maryland Trust Act, which actually prohibits local and state officials from asking people about immigration or citizen status, among other things. The Obama administration has promised to retaliate by withholding federal funds. How will you handle that if indeed it occurs?
Well, what we've said to our federal partners and what we said to the governor is, you know, we don't want federal funds withheld from us because we're following the law, and that is, you know, we're not ICE agents. It is not our job to do that. It's the federal government's job. If they have people who have violated the law, they can certainly come in here and arrest them. We have a policy of we do not ask the immigration status of individuals who are victims or who are arrested. And that's the way it should be. There's a reason that the federal government is the federal government and the state government is the state government and the county government is the county government.
Here's Ann in Bowie, Maryland, on another issue. Ann, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Mr. County Executive. Nice Hello. To hear you on the radio. My primary concern is about your funding for individuals with disabilities in Prince George's County. We have providers that are doing such a great job. Montgomery County has put in some more funds. They always do. Washington, D.C. does so much for the disabled community. None of that is happening in PG. Why are you refusing to support the providers financially to be able to take care of our individuals with disability?
Well, thank you for the question. I mean, this is something that's come up in the budget situation in the county for the last, ever since we actually passed the minimum wage bill in Prince George's County. We are a leader, like the District of Columbia and Montgomery County, in passing an increase in minimum wage. And so we do our part in the county. By passing the minimum wage, we did our part. The reimbursement comes from the state. So actually where the gap is it the Hogan administration. And I've said all along that they should step up to the plate and make and fill those gaps. It is unfair to the people of Prince George's County to fill what is in essence a state gap in the funding for this area. These people with disabilities who work in the community, I know it well, probably better than most people who sit in my position, and they deserve a raise in pay. And it's one of the reasons that we have fought hard at the state level to make sure it's included. What we've done at the county level, which I think is appropriate, is we set aside money in this year's budget to work with training individuals with developmental disabilities so that they can actually get county jobs. But this fight really belongs at the state level because it's not just affects Prince George's County and Montgomery County. This affects people who work in Howard County, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore City, and those places. The state needs to step up to the plate.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the issue of the budget, and that was inspired by our caller, because there is some good economic news in your 2018
yes.
budget. How does the new casino fit into that picture, and where are you planning to boost spending?
Yeah, the new casino, this is the first year we've actually got the revenues, a full year of the revenues, projected revenues for the MGM Destination Resort Casino. that is helping us give more money to our education system. Not as much as they wanted.
I was about to say, you didn't give the school's chief as much as he requested.
Yeah, he wanted a lot. And what I've said to, you know, let me get the good news about the budget, because this is the Coach, don't take away
good news is what's supposed to happen. We're only interested in stuff that's
a $4 million budget deficit. It was so boring because it was so low that Arellis didn't even come out and cover it. No, I'm just
not
joking.
True.
But it does mean that not just MGM, it means that property values in the county are going up. We see the wages of the workers, going up in the county. All of that signals that, you know, the decisions we made in the very beginning of the Baker administration are starting to come to fruition. We're starting to see a mix of incomes, not just property values, but also commercial activity that's helping to increase our revenues. And therefore, we can actually start putting more money into programs. What I've warned our council when I submitted the budget is we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level. We already expect the cuts at the state level. You know, we're not getting anywhere near the assistance we have in the past on the state level. But we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level, and we have to be prepared for that.
Arellis.
Considering, you know, the cuts that we're expecting with the president's budget, do you have enough room sort of built into the budget where the county could, you know, supply the funding that might result in gaps for what housing is a big recipient of federal dollars?
Yeah. No, we don't. I mean, we simply, the honest answer is we're not going to be able to make up for what we're going to lose at the, or potentially could lose at the federal level. Just in the Affordable Care Act alone, I mean, we were able to have, you know, reduce 50% of the uninsured folks in Prince George's County because of the Affordable Care Act. If that changes, those individuals go back to not having insurance. They go back to using our hospital as their emergency room. But as important is the whole new hospital is predicated upon people having insurance. And that means there's a bigger gap in terms of the funding that Prince George's County and the state would have to put into that. At the housing level, we can't make up for those with those resources. So we would do like most jurisdictions, and that is turn to the state and say, you know, can you help us with the gap? Now, I can tell you for the last 2-3 years, that has not been the case. We have not seen it, at least at the Hogan administration. And so we're going to be in real trouble. And like I said, I'm going to be on Capitol Hill later today and is talking to them about how important this is.
On to the phones again. Here's AJ in Fairfax, Virginia. AJ, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I've been very displeased with the narrative coming out of other media regarding the alleged rape incident. I don't think this is an immigration issue. It's a security issue, and I'm curious as to whether or not
I agree.
The school system has any leadership in the school system has any plans to sort of reformulate that narrative.
Well, I can't speak for Montgomery County, but I can speak for Prince George's County. You're absolutely right. It's a security issue. Everyone sending their children to our schools should be safe, which is why we not only made sure that our security, the school system's chief security personnel is in our meetings, but that we're communicating on a daily basis on how to make our schools safer, because that's the important thing is we have to look out for that. And that's number one. And that's why this incident or incidents like this happen.
Thank you for your call, AJ. President Trump released his federal budget proposal last week, and transit would be a big loser if it passes, including the Purple Line. It's in Congress's hands now, but is there any way forward without that federal money, and what would it mean for Prince George's County?
No, it is no way forward without the federal. The Purple Line would be dead without the federal funds, and that would be a shame, not just for Prince George's County and Montgomery County. This is really an economic development opportunity for the entire state of Maryland and this region. It helps Anne Arundel County and Howard County with their economic development plans because people are able to use the Purple Line and make us more competitive with getting jobs and businesses here. I think if the what I would say to the Trump administration is that if you're really about business growth and business friendly, then there's nothing could be, you know, greater than the Purple Line. Businesses are going to grow up and industries are going to grow up around the Purple Line, which is why we want it so much. It's an economic development as well as a transit and environment tool.
Aurelis?
Considering, though, that today we heard or in the last week that metro rates are going to go up, that this could impact ridership, how did those numbers and those issues impact sort of the conversation around the Purple Line and whether in its utility?
Yeah, well, I think what we've said around the Purple Line, and we'll get to the rates in a minute, but around the Purple Line, what we've told, the state, our state partners, you know, and the reason we were willing to put county money into this project is it's an opportunity to grow jobs, you know, ridership, yes, but job opportunities, because we know economic development around metro centers or metro areas is really what's driving right now. And so the Purple Line itself would create a number of jobs, not just federal jobs, but jobs that support the federal government. And we think that would help ridership. Also, a number of people who are going back and forth in Maryland would be able to, you know, access the metro. So we believe that, you know, certainly metro has to do some things, and I think they're trying to do this now better to get more confidence in the ridership, to get it back up to where it was. But the Purple Line would help us make business centers where you have more people who would take the system out to these areas.
The long-awaited decision about where the new FBI headquarters will be located has been delayed indefinitely. Prince George's is a leading contender for that $2.5 billion federal project. What does this delay mean for Prince George's County?
Well, you know, it means that we're disappointed we didn't get a decision earlier. We're still prepared and committed to having the FBI come to Prince George's County. We have the two best sites. I think this is a matter of security, national security. You have an FBI aging building. You have agencies that are spread around the country. So having a consolidated FBI in one location is very important for national security. And we believe our sites are the best ones. It will also help ridership for the metro system because more people will be able to come and take the metro out to Prince George's County rather than where it is now.
We got an email from Elijah. I just bought my first home in Capitol Heights, and I've been somewhat shocked by the lack of basic services. The only grocery store for miles, Safeway, closed back in July. My commute to the train station involves dodging cars on Central Avenue because there is no safe crossing and no streetlights. I've seen a commitment of resources on the D.C. side to improve Ward 7. Can the county coordinate with D.C. and match those efforts?
Well, one, if there are any, so the caller knows, if there are any problem with the streetlights or traffic concerns, our 311 County Click, you can go there and report those incidents. And on the other thing, that's a very good point. We've tried our best to coordinate our development with what the district is doing and vice versa. So if you look at where the county resources has been devoted, it's all been inside the Beltway, as we speak, areas, whether that's Suitland, whether that's New Carrollton, whether it's Capitol Heights, Mount Rainier and Colmar Manor and places like that, so that we kind of coordinate our efforts. And we're going to continue that. The grocery store issue is a big one. There are areas in the county where we have, you know, food deserts, you know, on Capitol Heights is one of those areas we're looking at, but also where I live in Cheverly. We just got an Aldi's there, you know, a couple of years ago, but clearly a variety of things. So we're making progress in the county. Are we there yet? No, but we're happy we'll be opening a new Whole Foods in a couple of weeks.
But
outside the Beltway, though, right?
Yeah, but you know what happens, what I found with the economic development is when you have it in one place, it's easier then to move it to other areas. We've seen that with what we're going to do in Suitland. We wouldn't be able to do the development in Suitland had we not seen growth in Riverdale and in New Carrollton areas. So I think it'll get people to start looking, you know, private sector start looking at the county.
What kind of coordination, though, are you doing with mayors or a bunch of municipalities there in the Inner Beltway, Capitol Heights, Fairmont Heights, Hillcrest Heights, in order to coordinate some of that infrastructure improvements in those very, you know, some of them blighted neighborhoods?
Yes. I mean, so what we've been able to do is, so we have what we call our Transforming Neighborhoods Initiative, where we look at the areas in the county which are the most challenging. And what we've begun now to do is coordinate those efforts with, you know, the various mayors inside the inside, in whether it's Capitol Heights, Sea Pleasant, or places like that. And that's really what, and we I have meetings with them, so we have a municipal liaison, so I'm always abreast about what the issues are, and they're abreast about what our policies are in terms of economic development and in terms of, you know, public safety.
We're running out of time very quickly. We only have about a minute left, but the county recently rolled out a data Prince George's. What is that, and how can it help county residents understand what's going on in their government?
Well, this way they'll be able to access their government and on the Internet and have information full time. So not just being more transparent, but the ability to see what's going on and report it to us. And so, you know, it moves us to another level of high tech information for citizens throughout.
Rashawn Baker, he is the county executive for Prince George's County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Arelis Hernandez was our guest analyst today. She is a reporter for The Washington Post covering Maryland. Arelis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today, but we've got more going on for you online. You might have seen the news that a restaurant has sued a property owner over the paid parking policy at Reston Town Center. We hosted a conversation about that parking issue earlier this week. You can find it in our show's archives, and we're still looking for your feedback about parking pandemonium in the region. So if you've got thoughts about parking in your neighborhood, email them to us at kojo@wamdu.org or tweet us at Kojo Show. We'll be back here Monday at noon. We'll explore the community conversations happening in Montgomery County, Maryland, after an alleged rape inside of a local high school. We'll also talk to a local writer, Laura Lippman, whose new book takes place in Columbia, Maryland. That's at noon Monday. Until then, have a great weekend, and thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. You just still have the opportunity to make the announcement about when you're going to run for governor here on this broadcast right now.
I can't wait to come back and talk to you about that.
Arelis, what can we do to make him say something?
Poke him a little more.
Rashawn Baker, once again, thank you for joining us. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Joe Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Inglisa Schroepsdorf, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.